Hi, this is Alan Chartok. With us today is Dr. James Gosso, president of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Dr. Gosso became president July 1st, 1998, after having previously served as dean of the Beauvais College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences at Northeastern University. He will step down from the position on June 30th and has joined us today to reflect on his early years and days at the school, the growth of the college over the past 16 years, and why he feels now is the time to step down. Welcome, Jim Gosso.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So let me start by this. What was your training? You know, now the new look in academia is a lawyer becomes the head of the medical center. What about you? Tell us about your background.
Well, I got my PhD at Boston College.
In
immunology.
Immunology.
Immunology, immunochemistry. And then did 3 years of postdoctoral experience at Harvard Medical School. In the early 70s, I joined Northeastern University as assistant professor. And I was involved in research that related to organ transplantation at Northeastern, and eventually became dean at Northeastern. I was dean of the Beauvais, as you mentioned, College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. And from there, I came out to Albany.
Did you like being dean?
I did. It was a chance to affect change and to try to improve things.
Now, do people resent authority? I mean, one very cynical professor once said to me that the definition of a dean was a mouse studying to be a rat. Is that true?
It's interesting. Having been a member of the faculty for so many years, it's almost as though when one moves into administration, one moves to the dark side.
The dark side.
Of things. And you do see things from a different perspective and have a wider view, you know, versus what you see from the perspective of an individual faculty member.
I hate to do this as a 40-year in-the-trenches academic, but I want to ask you this, because this will be seen as a traitorous question. Do academics have it too soft? You know, my wife, first she was at Monument Mountain High School between Stockbridge and Great Barrington, where we both lived for a while.
Yes.
And she taught 5 classes a day, every day, started earlier, ended later. And then academics come along and they teach maybe a course or two a week. She went on to college teaching and has had survivor's remorse ever since, leaving the others back there to do it. Do you think academics have it too easy?
No. I think this is a great deal. You didn't expect me to say yes.
I knew what you were going to say. Yeah, go ahead.
There are a number of responsibilities.
Oh, they got to go to committee meetings.
Faculty obviously teach, in many cases, teach more than 2 courses. They advise students, guide students, mentor students. They serve on a number of committees. They're part of the governance of the institution.
You don't really believe that. In the end, all college presidents think that the governance of institutions is them. I mean, I would if I were that. And saying, okay, so you appoint all these committees, but then they always say, there's not enough. We don't get enough power.
Well, of course, the Board of Trustees. You know, the board has a final authority.
Sure.
But from my perspective, I listen very carefully to faculty opinions. And they move me as well as students. And I really am quite responsive. But in the end, there are always differences of opinion, and you have to make a decision, which in many cases will be finalized by the Board of Trustees. Getting back to faculty responsibility, another major responsibility is scholarship and research. And it takes a lot of time and effort. And faculty, I would say a typical faculty member, tenure track or tenure, devotes more of his or her time in scholarship.
That's nice. But as I say, I was in the field a long time. Sure, there were some people like my pal Jerry Benjamin at New Paltz who, for years, post-tenure, puts out one book after another. I can't even count the numbers that he has. But then there were the people who decided to sort of retire and stay. How does a president of a college or a dean or an academic monitor the people who just said, okay, I got tenure, now I'm staying?
Well, there are obviously many different individuals. You know, there are some that are tenured that become even more aggressive in terms of trying to seek funds for the scholarship and work very hard on their teaching.
Because they own their jobs, yes.
They own their jobs, and they're really looking to advance themselves professionally.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Which, you know, the academic life and world gives them a chance to really do that. To a major extent. And then there are others that they may have an interest in scholarship. They may lose their grants. They may lose their funding. And it may be difficult in many cases for them to continue. What we try to do at our institution is balance each faculty member's responsibility. If a person isn't as actively involved in scholarship, they're more likely to do more teaching. If a person, on the other hand, is very actively involved in their research and scholarship, then their teaching probably would be less.
But what if they haven't done either, Jim? I'm sorry I'm giving you such a hard time, but does the president or the dean or the chief academic officer call them in and say, hey, you know, you're sloughing off?
Well, there are always cases, but those cases are extreme. And there are some challenges. And there are some that, you know, don't put as much time into their teaching as they should. But these are rare occurrences. Yeah. I mean, most people, most academics are committed. They're student-centered, and they work very, very hard.
James,
and I would like to see them be rewarded at a higher level, personally.
Let me go to the uniqueness of a college of pharmacy. What is it that you do there?
Well, in a way, we're fairly typical. The uniqueness is that our students, not only pharmacy, but we have five BS programs, we have graduate programs. All of our students are in health-related programs. So the uniqueness is the fact that we're a health college, health-centered college, either from the practice end or the other research. We're typical.
How long does it take to get to be a pharmacist these days?
6 years. The required degree is a doctor of pharmacy degree.
Wow. So that's a long time. That's more than it used to be, right?
Well, yes. I mean, depending on how far back you want to go. If you go back to the 40s, it was a 2-year or 3-year program. Then in the 50s and 60s, a 4-year program. Then a 5-year program, which I think was mandated in the early 60s.
Who mandated it?
The accrediting agency for the pharmacy schools and pharmacy programs.
And why? Why is it 6 years?
It's 6 years now. It's a doctor of pharmacy program. That's a good question. It's 6 years primarily because of the fact that drugs are more complicated. It's important for pharmacists to have some awareness or knowledge of various disease states and ramifications of certain diseases, drug interactions.
You bet.
It's a great deal more complicated now than it was kind of years ago. At one point, it was just dispensing, and the physicians essentially oversaw health care and were involved more directly in disease state management. Now, pharmacists are beginning to play a larger role and are helping people, helping guide them through their disease states and explaining to them more about their medications and drug interactions, the benefits, some consequences of not taking drugs or taking too many drugs.
My pharmacist, she was terrific. They just transferred her from, you know, my place to another place, which is bigger. And she's, by the way, a graduate of your fine, wonderful institution. But I wanted to ask you this. You've hinted at something, and I know you're going to run like hell from it. But I'm going to ask you anyway. Right now, if you want to get your flu shot, you can go in. Your pharmacist is now allowed to give you the flu shot.
That's right.
If you want to get your shingles shot, your pharmacist can give you the shingles shot. They know as much or more than most physicians do about drug interactions, right? But it's all about money in a way. Physicians are never, in this country, in my opinion, going to do what they should do, which is to allow the pharmacist to practice medicine on a larger scale. I'm all for it. You know, I have great trust in these people, not only to the point where I would entrust my health care to them, but why shouldn't they do as they are allowed to in some other countries, be allowed to prescribe? You walk in, you got a condition, you need an antibiotic, they ask you a couple of questions, they give you the antibiotic, and I know what the physicians will say about this. Well, we were trained in a different way and all the rest of it. But are we heading in that direction? Wouldn't more people be served that way?
I think one of the challenges, yes, I think one of the challenges in this country is for different healthcare providers to be able to work together more efficiently. There's limited communication among the various healthcare sectors regarding the patient. It's too individualized from my perspective. And that remains to be a challenge, and I think it's largely a turf issue.
Well, what do you mean by that? I'm sorry, I need a little definition when you say individualized.
Well, I mean, right now, the physician sees the patient from a unique perspective, from more of a holistic perspective.
Maybe, because as soon as somebody says, I say, you know, my urine looks a little strange, they send me to a kidney doctor. I say my sugar numbers may be slightly elevated, somebody sends me to an endocrinologist. So I'm afraid that all of that has gotten to be so separate and disparate that who's watching the store? The whole person.
Well, I think the overall scope of practice, again, needs to be better managed and better coordinated. In my opinion, there are too many kind of turf issues in the healthcare environment.
Including within the doctor.
Within the doctor, it's kind of segmented. it would be in the best interest of the patient to have some coordinated care and better oversight regarding the individual disease states. The pharmacist can, as you say, play a critical role.
And, a critical and clinical role.
That's right. A critical and clinical role. And I think pharmacy is moving more in that direction where people are accepting. I think a typical view of a pharmacist, if you ask the average person on the street, what does a pharmacist do? Well, they count pills, they move pills from a big bottle to a small bottle. But I don't think the average person understands the educational background.
6 years! We're talking 6 years.
Has. In many cases, pharmacists, after completing 6 years, they complete a residency or a fellowship where they get even more highly specialized training. And pharmacists are more aware of the various drugs and drug interactions than any healthcare practitioner, if you look just at education and what their course and core requirements are in order for them to attain that degree. But it's focused. It's focused on understanding various drugs, the chemistry of drugs, how drugs interact, and the consequences. And one thing that perhaps we've been deficient on from an educator standpoint is in better educating the public to better understand and accept the potential role of a pharmacist.
So who's going to lobby to do that? To me, I think we agree. I'm sensing we agree that it makes great sense to give them more clinical responsibilities. Because we have a healthcare crisis in this country, we have to open it up. But it is all about money, right, Jim? I mean, it's about money. Doctors are the right to prescribe is the right to make money. Let me shift for a moment and talk to you about Big Pharm. You're the president of this institution. You have to raise money for it. I have to raise money here. The question is, does Big Pharm, do the big companies chip in?
They do. The big companies are supportive, but they're not supported from, just a strict giving sense. It's rare for a school to approach X person at Big Pharma and say, can you donate X amount to the school for scholarships and for other purposes? The big companies are more likely to do what's in their best interest, kind of a win-win. Many of our faculty are supported by drug companies on various projects. Faculty will be investigating, for example, a drug and work on a clinical trial and coordinate that with a drug company. If a drug company is interested in a new formulation, for example, for an existing drug, they might ask a faculty member, can you help us with this on a contractual basis? So we do generate and see a significant amount of support, not only do we, but other pharmacy schools as well. So they're more apt to support academic institutions from the perspective of what ultimately potentially will be in their best interest. Some do award minimal amounts of scholarship funds for students because we'll award a scholarship fund, for example, from X company. But the larger funds are related to grants and larger projects.
Now that you've raised that, Jim Gazzo, let me ask you this. How much does it cost to go to the College of Pharmacy?
The overall cost, tuition, room and board, is $35,000, $37,000.
Well, that's a deal.
Close to $40,000.
That's a deal compared to some of the larger institutions which are charging $65,000 a year.
We feel it is. The job market is strong. And
you bet, right? Everybody gets a job.
Everybody gets a job.
And what's the starting salary?
The starting salary is about
$110,000 for somebody who's, yeah.
Yes.
That's terrific. And then, of course, in order to make it fairer, the idea is to have some scholarship funds for people who can't possibly afford it, right?
We work very hard. I do in particular to raise funds to endow scholarships, you know, for various purposes. We have at our institution a significant amount of funds. Roughly 22% of our budget is devoted to scholarship aid for students. We wish we could do more, and we're looking to strive to try to enhance that, but that's important. The average debt of a pharmacy student is about $100,000 after 6 years.
Well, so if the average salary, first salary is $110,000, that doesn't sound so bad compared to what some of the physicians go through after graduating from medical school.
Yes, yes.
So why are you quitting?
Before I came to Albany, I was dean for 10 years, in administration for 10 years. I've been president at Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences for 16 years. The average presidential term, as I'm sure you know, is around 6 years.
Yeah.
And at this time, I'm 70.
A mere child.
I have grandchildren, 9 grandchildren,
wow.
3 children. Our son is in Texas, and 2 others are in Boston. My wife has been with me in Albany, and it's just time, and you know when it's time. And I didn't think I would. I thought I'd do this forever. Mm-hmm. I had no intentions 3 or 4 years ago, but largely for personal reasons.
And where are you going to go? Are you going to stay around, or are you going
to? Well, my intention is to take a year off, and to eventually come back and hopefully teach, probably on a part-time basis.
Sounds good. We're talking with Dr. James Gozzo, president of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. And as you can see, there are lots of things to talk about. Who lobbies for the colleges of pharmacy? In other words, we've been talking about some, as a political scientist, I'm always interested in this stuff, where power resides. Obviously, there is always going to be some tension between the medical community and the schools of pharmacy. You tell me that pharmacists make, $110,000 when they graduate, which is getting pretty close to what the average GP is making in this country. They may be making $50,000, more than that. But as I said before, the ability to prescribe is the ability to make money. If you're authorized to prescribe and you keep everybody else out, then you can make money. But you make the point that we really have to give more clinical responsibility if we're going to run a decent healthcare system to pharmacists. So somebody's got to pass those laws, the legislature, the Congress. Who will go make the argument?
That's a very complicated question.
That's why I asked.
There's, the academic side and then the professional side.
Yeah.
On the academic side, there's one central organization, the AAC, American Association for Colleges of Pharmacy. And they historically have been the prime movers to advance pharmacy education. So they're kind of moving education in a very strong clinical direction. Then there are professional groups, the boards of pharmacies and other groups that lobby. Our students lobby. We had a legislative day where students and some faculty visit legislators and talk about pharmacy, talk about the potential. We have an alum who's a member of the assembly, John McDonald, who's a pharmacist and owns Barris Pharmacy in Cohoes. And John's a strong advocate of pharmacy and healthcare. So it's through these combined efforts. But in addition, there are other groups that perhaps have different views that approach.
That's putting it mildly.
that approach, government officials with different perspectives. And in the end, they have to make what they feel is the best decision.
Well, are we making any progress here?
I think so. I mean, New York, as you probably know, is one of the last states to allow pharmacists to immunize. Mm-hmm. And that required a major effort on the part of the schools, professional groups, and other organizations to allow pharmacists to immunize. And there were groups that opposed that for some of the reasons that you stated. But now pharmacists immunize, and in the end, it makes ultimate sense in that there's a pharmacy on every corner staffed by pharmacists. And because of the fact that pharmacists can immunize, I think resulted in a greater number of people getting immunized. And people now understand, well, they can go
without question.
They can go into a pharmacy, see a pharmacist, and get their flu shot. It took a while for people to get comfortable with that. You mean a pharmacist who counts pills and puts them in a bottle can now give me a shot? And I think people now have settled into that and become comfortable with that. And so just think of the impact that's had on society. And the pharmacist is the most really accessible healthcare provider.
No question.
You can walk into any store and talk to a pharmacist and ask questions. So it's something that we continue to promote. Should they prescribe? My personal view is they should in a minimal
way. Why don't you talk about that for a minute, just so that everybody understands what we're talking about when we say prescribe. I think everybody sort of gets it. But somebody goes in with a high temperature and a couple of questions, and you'd go into a physician. The physician would give you an antibiotic. And in some countries, that is done with a pharmacist. Why shouldn't it be done here?
Well, I think it should be done. I think a pharmacist clearly has an educational background to—
With 6 years.
To assess.
Yeah.
But— There are economic reasons why I think that's not done. Mm-hmm. But it's one of the challenges. And I think in time, I think we'll see more flexibility, particularly as more people gain access and want access to health care. And there are limited strategies as to how one can achieve that.
In a school of pharmacy such as yours, a major academic institution, which is a huge part of the Albany health care complex, decides that it wants to get out there and interact with its community, how do you as president do it? In other words,
how do our students do that? How do I do that?
How do you do it? You are the leader. You're retiring now. But obviously, it can be insulated, or you can try to, in some way, deal with the other institutions. For example, the Albany Healthcare Complex, St. Peter's around the corner from you, or the Albany Medical Center, a great institution. And obviously, we've been talking about some of the differences between what doctors do and what pharmacists do, so that raises an intellectual sort of barrier. But on the other hand, there are things that they can do together. Have you succeeded in that?
Well, let me first say that we couldn't have a pharmacy school or health-related school without working with some of the health providers in the Albany area and health providers in general. We have on our campus about 250 faculty and staff, a bit over 100 faculty.
And what's the budget for the place?
$55 million.
That's a lot of money,
$55 million. But we have about 400 adjunct professors. Our students in their final year are required to complete six-week rotations at various sites, community pharmacy sites, hospital sites, industrial sites.
What's a community pharmacy?
Independent pharmacy.
And the other two are, again?
Industry.
Yeah.
And institutional or hospitals.
And what role do they play in industrial settings?
Students can spend one or two of their rotations in an industrial setting involved in research and drug development, get some oversight in terms of how drugs are developed. How does a drug get from the bench to the bedside, the manufacturing process? So they can learn and do learn, are exposed to a great deal.
Do a lot of your students go on to that side of the industry?
Of our graduates, about 60% move into retail or community pharmacy. Others will go on to work in industry. Some will work at clinical sites, clinical centers, hospitals. Some will go on to graduate school or professional school. We've had students go off to medical school. In the past, we've had many go on to law school. We haven't seen that recently based on the climate. Some go on to graduate school or pursue their PhD in the various research areas. So there's a real mix in terms of where our students go. There's so much potential, so many directions that they can pursue.
Yeah, but where's the money? In other words, $110 for somebody who goes to work at one of the major pharmacies. Is that the average salary or the beginning salary?
No, it's the average.
Some are obviously
less and some are more.
Yeah, okay. And then if money is really to be made, I know one person who worked in a local pharmacy who went on to be a salesperson, I believe, for one of the drug companies based on her expertise. What's the likelihood of that kind of thing happening? Do you see that?
It's possible. The starting salaries in industry initially are less, far less than what one would earn in retail pharmacy. But another way to look at that is the potential is greater. And if you, for example, get a job in a research lab at a big pharma, if you're successful, if you are involved in developing a new drug, the drug comes to market, and you do well, you can rise up. There are many stories of people that start at a low level and eventually move to be head of a company. One of our board of trustees, Gino Germano, is a pharmacy graduate from the 80s and who's now a senior member of the team at Pfizer and is doing extremely well and is very influential with the company. So there's so many examples, you know, of that. You start at a lower level, but the chances for growth are much greater in many cases if you measure growth in terms of salary and benefits than with the chain. But there are examples if one works for a chain, and there's so many examples where a person will start as a pharmacist and then get to a point where they are head of the chain. And that was a case at CVS, where Tom Ryan, who was head of CVS for years, was not a graduate of our institution, but started as a pharmacist and eventually retired as CEO.
So you talk to the students. Help us understand what they're thinking and why they went into the field. You know, it's easy to say, well, I wanted to serve mankind. But you know, I'm asking you as a dean, as a guy, as a president who's been around for a long time, what you're sensing? I mean, is it greed? Is it dedication? What is it?
Well, one is the students that enter our institution have a clear interest in science. So that's the first thing. You have to like and be good. So you have to, you know, be accomplished in chemistry and in biology and math. So that's the first step. The other is some exposure. The Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences for many years has been a very strong legacy school. When at one time, I understand there were over 200 independents just in the city of Albany.
And you say legacy, you mean?
The father typically owns a store, then the son takes over the store, and so on and so on. So we've had many, many generations, and that still exists to a point. And now with the independents, you know, phased out and the chains in, it's less so. So for years, it was primarily kind of a legacy school. It's the thing that you do. Now, students that come, one, have an interest, a strong interest in science, and that's absolutely critical. The other is interest in healthcare. And some, you know, might have worked as a technician or worked in a pharmacy in some capacity in a store. Mm. And you got a sense, well, this might be something I might want to do. We meet with students all the time, our admissions department, as young as freshmen. We have a program now where we have kids as young as grade 3 at the college.
Really?
Inner city youth. We call it the ACPHS Academy. The students that we have at the present time are from the Brighter Choice Charter School, and they're with us starting in grade 3, and they advance. We have now 110 of these young people with us from grades 3 to grade 8. The objective overall is to inspire and to get them to see, ideally, pharmacy, but to see a career in higher education. And our objective is to introduce them to science, and also to acquaint them with college life, so that it's not something that's mysterious to them at an early age. And I, many occasions, will go over and talk to these students and ask them, well, what do you want to be? What do you want to do? And it was just astounding. Not that we're brainwashing these young people, but many say, I want to be a pharmacist. And one other characteristic of the program is that every student starting in grade 3 is assigned a mentor, and a mentor is a college student, for the most part, a pharmacy major. So they get to understand, they get to talk to students at the institution, and then the relationship grows over a period of time. So the program is, in a way, in its infancy, in that we only have students in grade 8, but our goal is to eventually see some positive outcome, hope that they eventually enroll in the college, and if they do, we've committed to offer every student that's successful, that's interested, a scholarship to the institution.
That's wonderful. Let's shift to some of the major ethical issues that go on in pharmacy now. One of them is, you know, it's always occurred to me that somebody says, okay, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, has given its approval to a drug. Then we see millions of people taking the drug, or hundreds of thousands, and then we see, uh-oh, a bad outcome. What do you make of that?
Well, obviously, there's a very rigorous approval process that every drug, every new drug, has to undergo. Mm-hmm. And some people complain because there may be some drugs that have enormous potential but are not available to people that would like to take them. It's hard to know what effect the drug is going to have in 10 years or 20 years, and that if you waited that long, there really wouldn't be very many new drugs coming on the market. It's not a good thing, but it's important to monitor side effects, which is another reason why it's important for every individual to be as connected as possible to their pharmacist.
You know, but things change. I mean, all of us who have acid production issues and have to take a pill, and I've been on pills like that for a long time, and then along they come and they say, you know, by the way, we suspect that there may be a problem with your calcium in your bones as a result of taking this thing. So is there any way around that, or do we just have to really think that the fact that so many people take it and then from an epidemiological perspective, we can study what the outcomes are?
I think we just have to learn. I mean, there's no absolute way to predict or to understand outcomes. We're all different, and we all react differently to various drugs. 10 people can be on the same drug, and obviously there can be different reactions in each of the 10 individuals. I think the future of medicine will lead us in more of a positive direction, because I think the medicine of the future is going to be more personalized. If you have a certain malady or a certain disease state, your gene profile will be very clear, it will be obvious, so that the drugs you take, you know, ideally will be customized based on how you might react to those drugs. I mean, some of the drugs that are now causing consequences among very few individuals have very many beneficial effects.
You bet.
For a number of people. it would be ideal to understand why certain people, why a minority of individuals have consequences. And one way to do that would be to look at their genetic makeup and to see why they're responding as they do. I mean, some people are...
So with the I'm sorry, Jim, but with the outcome, with genetics playing an increased role, we all know where it's going. We're going to test. We're going to find out, do you have the potential for the disease? We even can do remedial stuff with that. You see a role for pharmacists in that?
Oh, yes. I think that, you know, the pharmacy of the future will have as part of its operation, I believe, counseling area, where you'll be able to look at and examine your profile with the pharmacist and then measure that against, relate that to certain potential outcomes.
Well, that's already true to some degree,
It's true to some degree. Mm-hmm. So the pharmacist will be involved and play a very critical and active role in customizing treatments for certain diseases.
Sure. I mean, in the case of people who have the potential for esophageal cancer, if you cut down the acid production, we know that, you know, the scarring or whatever else will be, you know, if the right word is obviated or cut down. But on the other hand, your bones may suffer. So you may have to have the choice, as long as you know what those choices
are. What the potential consequences are, right? And it would be ideal to look at one's genetic profile early on before the disease state is expressed, mm-hmm. and be able to, let's say, theoretically knock out that gene so the disease will never occur. So in a kind of a prophylactic way to prevent the disease from actually occurring.
And that may well be a drug?
It may be a drug or some procedure that will lead to the deletion or elimination of a gene that result in the expression of that particular disease state. So I think that's where we're going. As a species, if you look at experimentation in vitro in a test tube, right now it's been calculated that we, as a species, we have the potential of living beyond 125 years. And 125 and 150 years, if you look at cells and look at the potential of cell growth. So, you know, you measure that against the lifespan. The lifespan at the turn of the previous century was around 42. Now our lifespan is well into the 80s.
Is it?
Early 80s, in that range. In time, we're going to see many people that live fairly healthy state to 100. So where are we beyond that? Where are we going to be in 100 years or 50 years? Will we be at 150? Will we be at 125? You know, many of us may not want to stick around that long, but I think that's the potential.
Many of us won't have that choice.
Well, many won't have that choice.
Not yet.
But that's the potential. I mean, healthcare and medicine, my biggest frustration, one of my biggest frustrations is that I think based on the state of knowledge, there's so much potential, not only in this country, but in other countries throughout the world, to discover new drugs, discover new therapies. I would like to see, and I've been on this soapbox before, our government make a major effort to support biomedical research. It's very challenging for people to get grants to work on projects.
Well, they don't already? It was my understanding that what happened is that the basic science was done by, often, but not always, by government grant, and that the implementation, making it into a drug and a saleable drug, you know, then became the province of the drug companies. Is that a wrong impression?
No, that's basically correct. But the amount of grant money available for basic research is minimal. Uh-huh. I'll give you an example. I have a history of being successful in securing grant support. Now, I'm going back to the late 70s and 80s. When I was securing grant support, not only me, but others as well, roughly 25% of grants got funded. Today, when a person submits a grant, roughly half of the grants are not even reviewed. They're just triaged out. Of the grants that are reviewed, maybe 8% are funded. So it's very discouraging. Mm. The average age of an investigator in securing his or her first grant is in the 40s. When there are a lot of great young minds that are eager to do research. So if we want to develop a cure for a disease, you can have one lab working out a potential cure, or you can have 25 labs working out a potential cure. Chances are if you have 25, you'll find the drug or the cure for a particular disease. The knowledge is there. The knowledge base is there. But it comes down to the support and what one needs.
So we don't seem to have that problem. I'm sorry to do this to you, Jim, but we don't seem to have that problem building yet another nuclear submarine we don't need for billions of dollars.
No, and there are other government initiatives that cost, which we probably don't want to get into today, but also cost billions.
Yeah.
But of science, the discovery process is slow. If you fund a person today, you might not see any real outcome for 10 years. And I think many people in government like to see we're going to spend $1 billion for a new bridge. Well, you can, okay, here's the billion, here's the bridge.
Here's the Tappan Zee, or the Cuomo Bridge.
That's right, and here's the bridge. Science is slow, it's a slow process. It's not as exciting or as interesting as many of the political careers are less than 10 years.
Well, yes, but on the other hand, just trying sometimes helps. So for example, you get a very powerful, influential group like the AIDS folks who said, you know, you don't care about us. So we're going to chain ourselves to chairs in the legislature. We're going to do this and that. And lo and behold, all of a sudden, we can have cocktails, which AIDS patients can get because they insisted on being an effective political force. And people aren't dying the way they were.
I agree. If other forces could be mobilized.
Yeah.
But it's not something that people in general can relate to.
Yeah, but if the CP patients and their parents or others were to do that, we would see more outcomes, favorable outcomes for their individual groups. Don't they know that?
Well, I think theoretically they do, but I think it's hard to bring people together
to
affect any type of a transformational change. Mm. We've seen our government attempt to fund certain areas in the war on cancer, you know, for example, which was very popular going back to the Nixon era, but for a short time. But one of the easiest, I think, budgets to cut or perhaps eliminate is NIH, for example,
sure.
Because there's no immediate effect.
Jim Gozzo, I guess what I wanted to know, Mr. President, is along the same ethical lines, we now see drugs that are developed which turn out to have secondary uses that they weren't intended for. So in other words, we intended to alleviate pain, and then all of a sudden we have OxyContin, other things that become the hottest drugs on the street, to the point now where we read in the papers that the heroin epidemic has been reignited because people can't get these pharmaceutical drugs that they're used to. Have you thought about that?
Yeah, I'm obviously quite aware, and I've thought about it. I guess the challenge is, how does one deal with some of these issues? There's a high level of addiction.
To these drugs.
Addiction is quick. By that I mean a person that will take one of these drugs is addicted quickly and then needs more and more and more, and it gets expensive and gets to be a very difficult situation. I guess one question I would ask is, why are people resorting to these drugs? Is it an escape? Is it a reflection of society and so on beyond that? And I think it's a very serious, a very, very complex issue.
So is it on the pharmacists, Jim, to the pharmaceutical community not to hawk the drugs, but to make sure that they're not being overutilized or utilized in a way that they weren't intended?
Well, to an extent. You know, but their role is limited in terms of the overall influence, I believe.
If somebody shows up in the pharmacy, every doc, I just had a back operation and terrific result, but I got drugs prescribed. They said, we want you to fill them. I filled them. I didn't take one of them. You know, then
Yes. You
got to bring those drugs to the police station.
Yes.
Because the potential and the street value of them is so great. I mean, are these drugs being overprescribed?
They may be. To an extent. You know, I've been in a similar situation that you have. And my tendency is, if I don't have to take a drug, I don't take it.
Sure.
But it's there, and typically there's more than you need. I mean, that perhaps should be looked at. But there's a fairly high rate of addiction among young people. And in many cases, they see these drugs at home by going to their grandparents' medicine cabinets or their parents' medicine cabinets and find that some of these drugs just haven't been taken. So this is the first step. So that needs to be controlled. We have at the college during the course of the year kind of a take-back program where people can bring back medications, and we do that. We had one last week, and I think there's one in the city of Albany. I think we need to make the take-back process a little bit easier. In my opinion, and there are probably reasons why this isn't done, is why not just bring them back to the pharmacy? If you have excess drugs in your medicine cabinet, it's very easy. Take them back to the pharmacy.
Will the pharmacies take them?
I don't think so, because I think there are issues. You need to maintain an inventory. You can't just take a drug. You need to document what you take in. Drugs need to be disposed of. When we have our take-back program, we have to have police officers there. And then once we collect all the drugs, which we have to inventory, they're taken to a disposal center with some supervision. So the whole process, it's not just bring your drugs back and we'll put them in here and bring them someplace else. So there are some serious logistics that are involved in the process, and I'm sure it involves an expense.
Jim, when I was a kid, I don't want to get too specific here, but we would, when kid, meaning in my teens, and you were interested in, for example, birth control, it was always that moment that the, you know, condoms were kept in the back of the pharmacy.
Mm-hmm.
And you always had to go with some embarrassment to buy these things. And so that the pharmacist, who is the dispenser, becomes the ethical decider as to, you know, what's going on here. So do you offer serious ethics courses so that these pharmacists, these folks know what they're doing?
Well, we do offer some.
Now, things have changed, obviously. Now they're giving out condoms in the schools. But in those days, you wanted a condom, you went to the lady or the guy in the back of the drugstore.
I mean, students take courses in ethics and bioethics. But I guess you can argue to what extent a course will formulate, you know, will direct somebody to act ethically. I think it goes back to one's environment and one's beliefs in terms of how one might function in a clinical setting or a professional setting.
Well, just to hammer this home a little bit, isn't it really the responsibility of the educating institution? I mean, bioethics is a very interesting question. And all of the great things that your School of Pharmacy has been doing. But in the end, it comes down to the client and to the pharmacist in the pharmacy. And that while we, you know, maybe we don't want to really talk about, you know, what somebody, my uncle was a pharmacist in White Plains, and I used to go and stay there, but stay with him and watch him. But in the end, it comes down to this very simple relationship between people and their pharmacist. And when you say it depends on whether they want to listen to what they're told ethically, you wouldn't put up with that when it came to knowing what's in the drugs. Why isn't there more of a zealousness on the part of these ethical issues?
Well, I think, again, it's hard to be specific in responding to your question. It really comes down to the individual pharmacist, and pharmacists have different views.
Again. Well, don't you have to worry, Jim, about who you take in for that reason? I mean, medical schools, there are these interviews, right, before somebody gets in. And if you're a wise guy, I know one admissions person who said, absolutely not, we're not going to put up with this guy because he was a jerk. He may have an A average, but he was still a jerk.
Well, we essentially do the same thing. Let me tell you a bit more specifically about our program. Our program is a 6-year program out of high school. The first 2 years are basic sciences, humanities. The final 4 years are professional. In order for a student to advance to the professional year, they, one, have to have a certain academic average, but they're also interviewed. And we've had students that have done well academically that haven't had a successful interview. And we don't allow those students to progress.
Give us an idea of what somebody should not say. I take it you've been in some of these interviews. What should a student not say who was applying to a school of pharmacy and you were looking for certain key indicators?
Well, we look for positive communication skills. Is that person comfortable? Do we think that person would be comfortable talking to patients and talking to customers? Is there a certain degree of empathy that the individual has? If a person applies to pharmacy school, and typically we'll ask the question, why do you want to become a pharmacist? You know, typically they'll talk about healthcare and trying to affect some positive change. If they give an example, if they say, I'm interested in pharmacy for the money, that probably wouldn't be a very positive response.
Well, it may not be a positive,
but it may be an honest response,
and you have to be a big dope not to know that.
But you'd have to, you know, basically look at the whole interview. And then come to some assessment.
Sure.
If the faculty that are interviewing prospective students feel as though that individual is going to be a good fit. You know, for the most part, students do well.
What percentage of the people who apply get in?
We, as freshmen, we admit about 60% of those that apply. A typical student has strong SAT scores and is in the top 10% of their graduating class, high school class. In order for a student to progress to the professional component of the program, they have to maintain a B average, and about 10% don't achieve that level.
But how many who apply to get in of the original group? If 6,000 people apply or 10,000 people apply, who gets in? How many of those will get in?
About 60%.
60%.
Yes.
Okay. You've been president for, these 16 years?
It'll be 16 come July 1st.
What are you most proud of?
Again, that's a very difficult question. I'm proud of a number of things.
Okay.
But the thing that...
But this is your exit interview.
The thing that makes me the happiest is to see students come through a program, do well, and flourish professionally. All that we do, all that I do, is focused on each individual student. And I take that very seriously. During my time as president, I make every effort to meet with students periodically. One example is my assistant randomly selects a dozen or so students twice a month, and I have lunch with them. A typical lunch is, how are things going? Well, no, they can pick. We give them a coupon, and they can get salad or whatever they choose within limits. But a typical question is, how are things going? You know, what can I do? And over the years, students have made many suggestions. So a lot of the improvements, a lot of the advancements that we've made over the years have come from students.
Okay. As my mother would say when she would tell me that eat your food because there's, there's starving children in Europe. And the traditional answer is name one. Okay. So I want you to name one thing that you got from a student who you really considered, which you really considered to be something that was worth implementing.
I can name a number. I mean, one is, as we were growing, and we had limited study space. We had a library that housed only 130 people. So students, typically, we need more study space. And we did that. We expanded the library. We expanded the study space. Another example is a food service. We had some serious issues with the food service that I heard from students. So we attracted a new food service provider and now have a food court with a number of different, with a variety of foods. Issues with the curriculum. Students would come to me and say, this faculty member, there's some issues in this course. So I would go to the dean, to the department chair, and we would try to remedy some of the concerns that were raised.
Well, without naming a guy or a woman, name a concern in a course that you rectified.
Well, one concern was a number of years ago, I had a student come and said, I have this faculty member and come to class for 60 minutes. This person shows 60 PowerPoint slides and reads from the slides. And they found that is not too positive from an educational perspective.
We've all seen it. Yeah.
So we work on, try to work on and try to help in some of those situations. Students always have, suggestions regarding faculty. And I typically will say to them, okay, there are 12 of you here. What we say here around this table will stay around this table. But I want to know, tell me some faculty. Tell me some that are at the top end, but I also want to know some that are at the bottom end. They name names, and I do my best to somehow try to affect
mitigate.
Some change, to mitigate and try to be helpful. So they're very serious discussions, and I found that our students typically are very serious, are very committed, and always come in with the suggestions. In fact, I got an email from a student 2 or 3 days ago, and he asked to meet with me. He wants to talk about a project that he feels will really have a significant impact on the future of the institution. Now, I rarely get this sort of thing. I'm meeting with him Friday, so I'm anxious to see what he's going to come to. Now, from his perspective, it may be substantial, it may be major, but, in terms of the whole institution, it may not be as
I get it every day. Somebody thinks they want another radio show that they can do. Yeah. Okay.
Right. Yeah. So that's typical. So there are a number of issues that come up.
Yeah. So the scope of the school, it's a much bigger school than when you got here.
It is. We had about 500 students. We have almost 1,700 students. We have three campuses. We have a main campus in Albany, one in Colchester, Vermont, and we have a research institute in Rensselaer. And we had one building. But I can go on. We have a number of different programs. We had just pharmacy. We have BS, graduate, and we have a number of buildings on campus. So we've grown.
In addition to the
pharmacists,
Jim, in addition to the pharmacists, who else do you graduate?
We have five BS programs. I'll give you one example, a BS in pharmaceutical sciences, a couple of examples, a BS in microbiology, BS in chemistry, clinical laboratory sciences, health and human sciences. Those are all four-year BS degrees.
But these people don't all go on to be pharmacists?
No.
Okay.
The pharmaceutical science BS graduates, in many cases, typically go on to medical school, graduate school.
Oh, interesting.
Move into a research.
Do you think
career.
That the medical schools prefer those people, knowing that they were fully, you know, sort of trained in the right pre-med courses?
It's hard for me to answer that. We've had students from that program as well as a PharmD program go into medicine. Mm-hmm. Over the years, from the pharmacy program, go into medicine. I would guess from their perspective, they look at the individual, look at the background. Is this a good fit?
So, when you come back and you want to teach, which you say you want to do, what will you teach?
Well, my background is immunobiology.
And do you remember it all now? I mean, in other words, sometimes when you go into administration, you sort of lose some of it.
Well, I was able to maintain my involvement when I was at Northeastern because my lab was very close to my office. I tried to continue with my research when I came to Albany, but the job just pulled me away from that.
Sure.
in a major way, and I was not able to continue with that. My plan is to take this year's leave and to try to get retooled.
That's
to
a great
attend
idea.
Some scientific meetings. I've sort of kept up on the periphery, but not to the extent that need to.
Do you demand that your faculty publish? Is there a rule? My daughter just got tenure at the College of New Jersey. You had to have a certain number of published articles. And, of course, things are getting so tough now that, you know, she did it, and we're very proud of her. But refereed articles aren't easy to come by, are they?
No. In fact, we had our board meeting last week and just went through the tenure process for a number of candidates. And what we look for after 6 years, which is when an individual applies for tenure, from 6 to 12 publications in reputable journals, some grant activity, some community service in terms of giving lectures or talking about your subject matter.
In teaching.
But a level of expertise in a very defined area. And that's what we assess.
Well, let me just say this has been a wonderful hour. We've been talking with Dr. Jim Gosso, president of the Albany College of Pharmacy and Health Sciences. Jim, thanks so much for joining us today. I really wish you only the best in your future endeavors, of which I know there will be many, and I want to thank you for your service.
Well,
thank you so much for doing
it. My pleasure, and thank you very much for the time.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Shartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.